This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's been great to be with you on this Saturday morning. And today's going to be an interesting day. We have an interesting guest. We're in our program today. We're going to be chatting with Dr. Kevin Borup. Now, Dr. Borup is a doctor of public health. He's also the executive director for the Injury Prevention Center at Connecticut Children's Hospital. Now, as many of you will remember from a previous show, I was working with a family who had the unfortunate situation of a child who was accidentally drowned in a river. And we're seeing this rise in drownings. Actually, since the pandemic, when we look at numbers from 2020 to 2022, the numbers are clearly up, especially with regard to children. So I wanted to get someone on to really talk a little bit about safety in the pediatric population. And our partners at Covaris Insurance, they were instrumental in that. As you know, they're an insurance company. They work with doctors and other medical institutions, and when I told them about that, they came up with this situation that we can use and have Dr. Borup join us and talk about some of the things we need to do to keep our children safe, especially during the summer. This past week, I did a podcast. It was interesting being on the other end of the interview, and this was with Amber Pierce. Amber Pierce is a former patient of mine, actually, and she makes that well known publicly. She runs a podcast. She was a world-class cyclist who was injured and really is out of the world of cycling as a competitor now, but has a podcast. And is interesting because I needed to block out 2 hours of time to chat with her. Now, 2 hours is a long interview and a long time. And it was just such a great chat that I had. She's an excellent interviewer. And it's not posted yet, but I will direct people to it. And actually, she had many good questions coming from her listeners. So she has an army of listeners, primarily people who are active in the world of cycling and competitive cycling. So I think either today or in future programs, we'll talk about some of the things, the questions her listeners had, because I'm sure they're on other people's minds. This past week was interesting. You know, I don't like to get into the politics of things, and I'm going to steer away from that here. But I had to witness the congressional testimony of Dr. Anthony Fauci and how rude some of our elected officials were toward him. Dr. Fauci, no matter where you stand in the world of politics, Dr. Fauci's CV, his curriculum vitae, his list of accomplishments are astounding. I know I've said it on this program before. I first became familiar with his work when I was in medical school and in residency with the fight against AIDS. And Dr. Fauci is one of the few doctors who other doctors refer to as Dr. Fauci because he is at a different level. So to have elected officials that have no idea of his accomplishments and what he has done for society try to demean this man was a personal affront to me. To have to watch that. And I think people have to, you need to set some of your politics aside when you look at the work of someone who has contributed so much to society. It was very disheartening as many of the things are these days when politics gets involved. But, you know, when we're talking about medicine and science, boy, here's a man who's 84 years old and has clearly dedicated his life to public service. This day in medicine, June 8, 1870, was the day Dr. Max Brodel was born in Germany. Dr. Brodel is an interesting physician because he was an artist. Before going to medical school in Germany, and he became very instrumental in the world of medical illustration. And in 1890, he came to Johns Hopkins to work. And he started doing medical illustrations for Harvey Cushing, one of the most famous neurosurgeons. So when we think of medical illustration, we're talking about being able to generate very detailed drawings of organisms, of organs themselves, and diseased organs, pathologic organs. And you have to understand that at that time we did not have detailed photography and things such as that to draw on. So with that, he was able to really document what was going on actually in the operating room and looking at these various specimens. One of his successors was Dr. Frank Netter, a name we're familiar with here in Connecticut because at Quinnipiac University, the medical school is the Frank Netter School of Medicine. Dr. Netter is probably the most famous modern medical illustrator. I'll remember from my time in medical school, Dr. Netter's drawings that he produced for a drug company, Ciba-Geigy, was the drug company, and there were these Ciba-Geigy large volumes of published information and published drawings looking at different pathologies, and each volume looked at a different organ system. And we really relied on that so much in studying medicine, and they are truly beautiful drawings. So with that, we remember Dr. Max Brodel and his work back in the two centuries ago. One of the things coming up for this summer, and I'm focused on people going on vacation, is cruise ships. Right? A lot of people are going to be taking cruises. They take them year-round, and they're wonderful experiences, but they can be easily ruined. And I mean that because we're dealing with a lot of people in a closed area. And in this week, it was this week in Public Health On Call, Dr. Josh Sharfstein, who's a previous guest on our program, really talked about the possibility of norovirus. We hear about this all the time, where a norovirus becomes widespread. Now, norovirus produces gastrointestinal symptoms. And there are usually, when you're in a cruise ship, there are these large outbreaks. And the problem is because there's a long incubation period of 24 to 96 hours. And people are so close that it's important to really isolate. So if you were to come down with one of these illnesses, it's important for you to isolate for at least 24 hours after your symptoms stop. Just because your symptoms stop doesn't mean you're not still spreading the virus. Hard to do when you've paid a lot of money for vacation. So with that, a lot of people take liberties. And in fact, you shouldn't be getting on a ship if you already have an infectious disease that's ongoing and can be spread. The other thing we get concerned about are foodborne illnesses, and that's why food and things like that are inspected by standards on the cruise ships. It was interesting because in the talk they talked about who were the principal people who violated these standards when it comes to isolation on a cruise ship or not getting on a cruise ship if you're ill. And they found that it's really the people, the repeat cruisers, the people who do it a lot, are the biggest culprits when it comes to not following the rules. The big question is how to protect yourself in these cases. And what's interesting is he talked about hand hygiene, soap and water. Now, a lot of people, and myself included, like to use alcohol, Purell. We use it when we go in a room, come out of a room. But the norovirus in particular is very resistant to alcohol, the way it's shaped and the way it's structured. So really, the only way to get out ahead of this is by hand washing, soap and water. Now, in most modern cruise ships, before you enter an area with food, there's food, there are usually large sinks with soap and towels. Use them. They may not be mandatory, but use them to protect yourself and to protect others around you who may be fellow travelers. Another article I came across this week was about medical tourism. And this is, we're seeing more of it now, where people will travel to a different country to have either a surgical procedure or some other procedure done because of the cost. The out-of-pocket cost is prohibitive here in the United States. And before you do something like that, you really need to get your information squared away. You should consult with your physician here in the United States and also someone who's experienced in travel medicine. Now, travel medicine specialists really look at the country you're going to make sure you have the appropriate vaccinations and the appropriate way of dealing with any problems that develop. Also, research where you're going. Just because it's out of the country does not mean that these institutions are not followed by accrediting various boards. So are they an accredited institution? The other thing also is many physicians who practice in foreign countries trained here in the United States. They did their residency, fellowship, some medical school, and then returned to their country, their home country. So again, look at the physician who is going to be doing the procedure and look at their credentials. There may be a lot of information about them here in the United States. Pick a safe destination. Okay, there are many different countries that we make clear from the State Department not to travel to. And so make sure you're going to a safe destination and have an emergency plan. If you need to get out, you want to have an exit strategy. Another thing is plan your recovery. So after having the procedure, it's often unsafe to travel by air. We know it is often for at least 7 to 10 days. So be sure that you have a way of recovering after the procedure without having to return home. And as always, infectious diseases, medications, treatments, and FDA approval, these are things you have to take into consideration. So people are not saying don't do this, but by the same token, before you do something like this, it's a big step. Don't just take the word of a neighbor or a friend. You really have to investigate where you're going, who's doing it, and more importantly, if something goes wrong, how is it going to be dealt with? We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest today, Dr. Kevin Borup, and we are going to be talking about injury prevention in children. If you wish to get in touch with us, you can do so at info@AlessiMD. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with my guest today, Dr. Kevin Borup. Dr. Borup is a doctor of public health. He is also an attorney, and he is the executive director of the Injury Prevention Center at Connecticut Children's Hospital. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Well, Tony, thanks for having me.
Hey, let's talk a little bit. First of all, tell everybody a little bit about your background and how you became interested in public health.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as you gave that nice intro to me, I do have a law degree. I have a master's in public admin and a doctorate in public health. Although I will clarify, I'm not an attorney in Connecticut. I'm admitted in New York. But I first actually became interested in injury prevention and exposed to it in law school, going way back to the 90s, where I became a volunteer in the Camden County court system for victims of domestic violence. And I guess I had a fortunate childhood where I was not exposed to that. And that experience working in the domestic violence unit really opened my eyes to what people were going through. And from there, I ended up doing some work volunteering in, at the time in Philadelphia, working with a community group, a justice-based community groups, to help community members identify and shut down drug-dealing bodegas in the city. So that was really my intro to injury and violence prevention. Although, I'll tell you, at the time, I had no idea what public health was. It wasn't until later on that I discovered this whole world of public health.
And with that, it's interesting because I think many people didn't really become familiar with public health until COVID and the whole field of public health and the importance of keeping people safe, specifically, obviously, with infectious diseases and COVID. And yet, I don't know that people think of public health from the standpoint of, as you've brought up, domestic violence and accidents themselves. But taking it a step forward, really, what is the Injury Prevention Center at Connecticut Children's Medical Center?
Well, the Injury Prevention Center at Connecticut Children's is designed to do whatever it can to reduce and prevent injuries. And I guess before I describe the center a little bit, we should talk a little bit about what I mean when I say injury. What an injury is, and the way we define it scientifically, is a physical damage that results when the human body is subjected to levels of energy it can't tolerate. So something then happens, some damage to the body. It can also be impairment that results from the lack of vital elements like air, water, or heat. Okay, so when we're talking about injury, all the things we deal with are this transfer of energy. If we talk about car crashes, often we're talking about this mechanical energy. There's also radiant energy, thermal energy, like when things are too hot, electrical energy, and finally, chemical. It could be, you know, poisoning, intoxication, or something like that. So the Injury Prevention Center at Connecticut Children's is designed to address all those things, but related to children. The center itself was founded in 1990, long before I got there. And in 1990, a group of doctors and PAs, nurses, and other folks got together and said, we should really do something about all these injuries we see. And the center itself started out with a $4,000 grant from the local chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And from there, built a center around four core areas of activity: research, community outreach, education and training of everything from high school students to college students, medical residents, and even doctors who are practicing right now. And then the final pillar is policy advocacy. And so our Injury Center at Connecticut Children's has a staff of about 12 or 13 full-time equivalents, in addition to a number of MDs and PhDs who are affiliated research scientists that work with us on through all four of those core areas to prevent injuries to kids.
We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Kevin Borup, and we're talking about public health and specifically injury prevention to children here in Connecticut. If you have any questions, you can email them over to me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with my guest today, Dr. Kevin Borup, who is the executive director for the Injury Prevention Center at Connecticut Children's. Kevin, right before the break, you were talking to us a little bit about the structure of the Injury Prevention Center. My question here, are there other injury prevention centers? Is this a nationally known movement? And how do we compare to others in other states?
That's a great question. And, you know, there are injury prevention centers around the country. In fact, there are CDC-funded injury centers in several states that have some federal funding to do the work. We do not. Our funding comes from philanthropic gifts and from contracts with the state or federal dollars. And because Connecticut Children's is a level one trauma center that's accredited by the American College of Surgeons, what the ACS requires of any level one trauma center is to have evidence of injury prevention activities. Now, we go, in my opinion, far beyond what's required by the ACS. But if you find a level one trauma center near you, they will have injury prevention activities and sometimes even an injury prevention center. So in Connecticut, Trinity Health is a level one trauma center. Connecticut Children's is a level one trauma center. Hartford Hospital is a level one trauma center. And Yale New Haven Hospital is also a level one trauma center. And they all have injury prevention activities to some extent or another.
Let's get right into the injury prevention side of things. I mentioned a little bit in the beginning of the program about a situation of drowning, and we're starting to see more drowning, especially among children, since the pandemic. Can you talk a little bit about what we can do as a group, as a state, in order to help prevent these tragic drownings, especially among children?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the first thing I want to say is we're lucky that we live in Connecticut. Connecticut, comparatively, is a relatively safe state. But there are still some, very much some things we can do to protect kids around water and to protect them from drowning. As the summer months come on, we do call it the trauma season for a reason. And that's because there is an elevated risk and an elevated risk of injury. When it comes to drowning, really, you see a couple of types of drowning. With younger children, the most likely place where they're getting into trouble is in a pool, a family pool, something like that. Whereas for older kids, teens, it's more of natural bodies of water. And so there are things that parents can do to protect kids in both instances. For one, even if you're going to a guarded beach or a guarded lake, that is no substitute for parent supervision and ensuring that even with older teens, that parents keep an eye on them in the water and ensure that nobody swims alone. When it comes to that backyard pool and that backyard barbecue, maybe you're going to someone else's house. Maybe people are coming to your house. There are all sorts of kids in a variety of ages in the water. Just ensure that the children are always watched by a water watcher. In fact, we recommend that you have an actual water watcher card that says water watcher on it, and you hand it to that responsible adult, and they're not doing anything else but watching the water. They're not eating that chicken. They're not drinking that beer. They are not on social media. They are purely watching the pool to make sure everyone's okay. And after they have a certain shift doing that, pass on the water watcher card to another responsible adult who knows what to do if there's trouble in the pool. And in that way, someone's in charge of doing it. And what we find in some of these situations, if everyone is in charge, nobody's in charge. So you want to make sure you have that designated water watcher. And that's one of the things you can do to ensure kids are safe this summer, beyond making sure that if you do have a pool in your home, and maybe your insurance company demands this, right, that you have that four-sided fence around the pool to make sure that young children especially don't get into the pool without a parent present.
Well, you made an interesting statement there about that we're fortunate to live in Connecticut because we're a relatively safe state. Why are we safer in Connecticut?
Connecticut, and we can thank, the citizens of Connecticut and the legislature who have continued to adopt rules and regulations overall that make us safer. I think one of the big examples of this is the transformation in teen driving laws in the state. And motor vehicle crashes, of course, are also a risk as we go into the summer season. And teens in Connecticut now, when you're 16 and get a license, it's not unrestricted, but there's a phasing in of the driving privilege. And this was done very purposefully in Connecticut over a period of years, starting in about 1995, 96, until the last major change in the law, maybe around 2013. And so now, to get a license, you go through several stages, all designed to give young people, teens, the most experience we can give them behind the wheel in the safest environment possible, because we know the more hours and the more experience that young people get behind the wheel, the safer overall they're going to be. In addition, of course, they just have to get a little bit older, because as we know, with brain development, and you probably know this better than I, you know, the human brain and that all those functions around impulse control and risk taking really aren't fully developed until about your mid-20s.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think a lot of people, you know, right away we think, well, the age of 18, you could be drafted, you could do this, you could do that. And we're always hearing about these fantastic things that teenagers have accomplished. But there's no arguing against physiology and the ability to make clear decisions. And we usually associate that with the age of 25. So I'm glad you brought that up, especially with respect to teen driving. When we talk a little bit more even about teen driving and phasing things in, what are some of the things parents can do on their own? I mean, we have legislation, but there are probably more practical things that parents should be doing as they go through this stage of teaching their children to drive and giving them this responsibility.
Yeah, you know, in Connecticut, one of the things that young people are supposed to have before they get their license is 40 hours of behind-the-wheel driving practice. And what I would say to parents, you know, there are two big things you can do for your kids. One is drive with them. Make time for them, because the more practice they have behind the wheel, generally speaking, the safer they're going to be as a driver. And you probably want to push those hours up as high as possible, beyond 100 hours with them behind the wheel. And you will see that that investment in your time will pay off in safety for your kid. The other thing you can do, and this is a little bit harder because economics are involved, you want to have your child drive pretty much the newest vehicle that you own, right? The newer the vehicle, the more safety features are going to be included in that vehicle. So instead of getting them that 20-year-old car to drive around, give them your car and you maybe can drive around in that 20-year-old car. That's probably the most unpopular advice that I give.
That's so interesting, because I think everybody just gives the oldest car to their kid, thinking the child's going to bang it up or do something with it. But I could see where it makes sense to give them the most technologically advanced vehicle, as much as everyone would hate to do that. I want to go back a little bit.
Absolutely, and that's why I'm popular with teens. They really like that advice that I give.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Especially if dad had a midlife crisis and bought some two-seater Porsche or something. But anyhow.
Well, and then I would say go back to the other car. The other thing you want
to make
sure.
Go back to the Volvo.
Don't get your teen a hot rod, right? Get them something where you've looked up the insurance institutes for highway safety and it's got a really good crash rating.
I want to go back to swimming again and water safety. Are we doing enough in Connecticut to getting young people to know how to swim? at a younger age? I always think, well, if they at least could tread water or something, even at a young age, or know how to keep themselves safe. But obviously, there are populations that can't afford swim lessons and things such as that. Is that a factor? Is that something we're doing, or are we? Is there a movement toward that?
You know, there is a movement towards that in ensuring that all children have the opportunity for swim lessons. There are programs, you know, in Hartford at the Y's, at the city level to connect kids to swim lessons. And if there's one thing that parents can do around drowning prevention, ensuring that your children learn how to swim is a big part of this. You yourself might not know how to swim, but definitely work to get your kids those swim lessons. It will serve them for the rest of their life and make them safer when they're in and around the water, for sure.
Kevin, I have a question that just came in from Kathy. And the question is, getting ready to send children to camps, whether they be sleepover or day camps, do you have any hints as to what parents should be looking out for when they sign their children up for these summer camps?
Well, generally, I'd say, what have other people said about the camp? Is your child in your own assessment ready to go to camp? And you know, does the child want to go? You know, if they want to go and you assess the maturity that they're ready to go, and the camp, you've looked at it, you've looked at reviews of the camp, you've investigated them online, you know that they have, you know, the appropriate supervision for your kids, then, you know, camp can be a rewarding experience for children.
Do people,
I know that's very general, but hopefully
now?
That helps.
Do they do a lot of sleepover camps now? Do you know that? I mean,
there are a lot of sleepover camps, sports camps, arts camps. Who knows? You know, Tony, some of them may not have survived COVID, but for those who've survived on the other side of it, there still are a lot of summer camps for kids that are overnight sleepaway camps. And of course, there are a number of day camps that kids can go to.
I want to move on to another topic, and that is guns and weapons and safety around children. You almost think it's a ridiculous conversation to have, that we need to keep guns away from children. But nevertheless, we see these injuries come up all the time. What are we doing in that respect?
Yeah, and it's a little bit alarming nationally. This is not Connecticut, but for the U.S. as a whole, in 2020, firearms overtook motor vehicles as the number one cause, essentially, of injury death for kids, right? So it's an issue. In Connecticut, again, I would say, luckily, we live in a state that has strong laws around firearms, strong laws around firearm storage. And, you know, if you are a firearm owner, that's what you need to do. Ensure that your firearms, when they're not under your personal control, that they are locked up and away from young people or an adult, any other adult who's an unauthorized user of a firearm, so they cannot get hold of that firearm. It's definitely continues to be an issue. In Connecticut itself, you know, when we look at where the problem with firearms are, it's really with firearm homicide when it comes to young people. Probably nationally, the numbers around suicide or self-harm go up quite a bit. But for Connecticut, where we're seeing firearms taking lives is in homicides for young people. And Connecticut, again, has good gun laws. And I think that we can only do so much within our own laws to work on this. There are probably a few more provisions we can things we can work on, but our borders, without going into it too deep, our borders are porous, right? And so we can't control what other states do. We definitely have an issue, especially in many communities in Connecticut. Unfortunately, we saw even last night in Hartford, as your news recounted, shots fired and people injured in Hartford last night. So we still have a problem with guns. And I think that in addition to gun laws, we have to look at communities that, again, we've disinvested in and look at ways where we can provide opportunity and invest in those communities to give people the power they need to change their own lives. And we will see a reduction in gun violence.
Kevin, are we still seeing a lot of problems with medication safety in children? I mean, most adults like myself often have to struggle with opening the childproof container. And I guess my question is twofold. First of all, when we went to childproof containers for medication, did that make a difference? And is there still a problem?
Yeah, it did make a difference when we went to childproof containers. But of course, young people getting access to these are even, you know, prescription drugs that adults have. But it can still be a problem when kids get a hold of these things if they're not put, what we say is put them up and away so that kids can't reach them. And we want to continue to do that. There's certainly still an issue. And I think when if you have young people in your home and you're worried and you have mental health concerns related to them, really ensure that you've taken the medications that you have, even over-the-counter drugs, and locked them up. You can get medication bags that you can stick all your medications in and keep them locked. And you just want to make sure that anyone who shouldn't have access to medication doesn't have it. So, but we have made a big dent in poisonings for kids, but it's still, you know, kind of when we were all growing up. Keep those detergents and all those other things that can hurt kids, store them high up out of the way. I know a lot of people, we want to store them under the kitchen sink. It's probably not the safest place.
I want to move on to environmental issues. And I thought your definition of injury was so good because it did talk about the environmental factors. Now, some people may want to deny it, but it's clear that our climate has changed. Those of us who are older remember that when we were children, there wasn't that much of a need or availability for SPF and skin protection and, you know, wearing sunglasses, not as just a matter of convenience, but as a matter of protecting your eyes. And now it's become fairly standard as we're looking out west in the past week, record temperatures again going into triple digits. And people are, you know, really trying to adapt to that where air conditioning has put a stress on the grid. Can we talk a little bit about environmental factors and their effects on children and injuries, sun or otherwise?
Yeah, absolutely. As you know, as we move into summer and we get these really hot days, it can be a real danger. And I'd say the first thing is, of course, the sun. You want to make sure that kids are really protected from the sun. You know, the skin on a child is a lot thinner than an adult, for one. They'll burn more easily. You want to get sunblock of SPF 30 plus and ensure that kids put it on and that it's reapplied during the day, especially if a child has gone swimming or in the water when they come out. Dry them off and reapply that sunblock. The other thing you can do is get those rash guard shirts, those waterproof shirts that you put on that also, when you look at the tag, you'll see an SPF rating. And those are great to put on. You can wear them swimming. And the great shirts to have in the summer, they dry off really quickly, and they'll also provide you with protection from the sun. So that's important. Keep your skin covered. We've all burned our ears from time to time. Get a hat with a brim and ensure that not only have you put on sunblock, but you do your best to protect your skin from its damaging rays. The other big issue is just getting, as you talked about, getting hot. And when your internal temperature of your body gets above normal, and normal for all of us is about 98.6, and it gets at 99 or above, it starts to become concerning. We're not talking about a fever or sickness where your body does this on purpose, but out in the heat. And we know that at 104 and above, that this can become life-threatening. There are things that you can do as the heat comes up to stay safe. And again, if you're over 65 or you're under 4 years old, you can be especially vulnerable to heat. And so stay hydrated. Talk to your doctor if you have certain medical conditions that may make you more susceptible. And then look at how you're reacting to the heat. You know, are you dizzy, blurred vision, fast breathing, headache? Do you have nausea or vomiting? You should definitely, as you feel yourself overheating, or remember, children will heat up more quickly than an adult. Bring them inside to a cool area. Drink something that restores electrolytes like Gatorade. And then if you feel it's more severe and people are really hot, don't delay. Call 911 and get help, because overheating can be life-threatening.
If there is one message, and we really have a minute to close, if there were one message you'd like to get across to parents and guardians and grandparents about keeping children safe, what would that be, Kevin?
You know, we see pediatric injuries increase in the summer, you know, from drowning, car crashes, being on wheeled vehicles like skateboards and bikes, dog bites increase, lawnmowers and fireworks. And a lot of this comes down to, as a care provider, exercise appropriate supervision over kids, give them experiences in the safest condition possible, and you'll protect them. So that's what I'd say. You know, be active in your kids' lives, and that'll go a long way to keeping them safe.
Dr. Kevin Borup, thank you. Thank you for your time today. Thank you for making us aware of the Injury Prevention Center and feeling better about living in the state of Connecticut.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Next week on Healthy Rounds, we're going to be talking about thyroid disease, and I have Dr. Pamela Ori Zizamia coming on. So if you have questions during the week, you could reach me at info@alessimd.com. Next up is going to be Law Talk with Attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rachford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.